Welcome to the Follow My Lead podcast, where we transfer stories and best practices of today's leaders to the leaders of tomorrow with your host, John Eads.
Welcome to another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. I'm your host, John Eads. This opportunity to have a conversation and learn from Peter Browning is certainly one of the highlights of the past five seasons of the podcast. To get this kind of access to someone like Peter was a real treat and something I'll remember for a long time. On the personal side, for those of you unfamiliar with Peter, he's 75 years old, in ridiculous shape. He's been married 42 years, has four children, seven grandchildren. He's a graduate of Colgate University and has a graduate degree from the University of Chicago. On a professional side, he spent 25 years at Continental Can. He actually has a Harvard case study called Peter Browning and Continental Whitecap that is still being used today. He was the chairman and CEO of National Gypsum, led a major turnaround there. He then went on to be the president and CEO of Sunoco Products, where he retired in 2000. He then went on to be a dean at the McCall School of Business at Queens for 3 years. He served on 12 publicly traded corporate boards, such as Wachovia and Lowe's, and been on multiple other private boards. He co-wrote the book, The Director's Manual, A Framework for Board Governance, in 2015, published by Wiley. And he now runs Peter Browning Partners, a board advisory services company in Charlotte, North Carolina. I honestly could have talked to Peter all day, as he poured out so many stories from his 50-plus year professional career. But here are just a few topics that we discussed from the conversation. We talked about Peter's great definition of leadership, the powerful practice of the leadership question box that he used when he was the CEO. He talked about why a CEO's job is 24/7 times two and why it can be lonely at the top. And maybe my favorite and most important part of the conversation was he talked about taking risk in your career. No matter how big or small of a company, it's really important to take risk. So drop whatever else you have going on, get out a pad and pen or open Evernote and take notes, because you will be able to use the stuff in this podcast for the rest of your career. So without further ado, here's my interesting conversation with the one and only Peter Browning. Just a quick housekeeping item. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft, an organization focused on teaching modern professionals how to add value to their organization and the world. Their Leadership Library subscription comes with access to 6 online programs, 25 micro-learning courses, member-only webinars, and personal coaching sessions. They have a special offer for podcast listeners only at learnloft.com/special. Well, Peter, thanks for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, John.
So you have as deep of corporate executive experience maybe of anyone in the country, really, when you really think about it that way. And I wrote a couple weeks ago about the definition of leadership that you provided, which was the capacity to elicit the willing collaboration of others over a sustainable period of time. Where did that come from?
Well, as a history major, of course, I'd been studying leaders, political and military, for a long time, but suddenly you're the dean. And one of the business school, and one of our principal programs was around leadership and leadership development. So taking all that into consideration and all the things that I'd read, I'd come across, actually, somebody quote somewhere that it was the capacity to elicit the willing collaboration of others. But what I've added on to that is that's fine, but that doesn't get you away from Hitler or others that...
Negative leadership.
Very bad. That can... So that was one. So have the capacity to elicit the willing collaboration of others toward a worthwhile goal. This isn't just about climbing up the hill and getting the troops all wound up. You need to do it over an extended period of time. That, to me, is real observable, sustainable, palpable leadership, that where you're able to get the team together. People do it in different ways. You do it over an extended period of time, and it's toward a worthwhile goal.
Why is the... over an extended period of time important? And I'll ask the question because most people, even in your examples earlier of turning around businesses, coming in at difficult times, how hard was it to think long term as a leader when, you know, the pressure of this quarter, these two quarters are on you to get results. How hard is it to think really long term when you're in some difficult situations?
Well, I mean, you have to do both, and that's what. And the leadership comes in 1,000 different forms, so people do this in different ways. Mm-hmm. But you need to be thinking about both. So what do you do? An example of the bankruptcy. So I'm thank goodness we kept the case over in Dallas, so we weren't worrying. That was in the papers here every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent half my time worrying about that. The other half was in the operating side of the business, visiting plants. If there were ever any questions on part of the team here, there used to be a movie theater over here and right around the corner from you, I'd shut the office down. We'd take 300 people over there. I'd take questions from a question box. If you want to know what's really on an organization's mind, take questions randomly from a question box. And then you address those. And I learned that lesson many, many years before.
How do you, but to interject there real quick, a tactic like that, right? I assume that is to get communication, open communication, not let people worry. People start to fester, think about losing their job. Was that the purpose for doing the open communication or the message box?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't call it a tactic. I'd call it a practice. And I first learned that when I took over a business where we had to do radical surgeries. My first chance to run a business was at Continental. We made paper disposables. We had to close plants. We had to lay off people.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to settle things down. The rumors were we're going out of business. So I thought, we have got to settle this down. So I'd go to a plant, would have 300 people there. I'd take questions from a question box, because they didn't really know me well. I was fairly new to that particular mm-hmm. business. And I learned that is the best way to understand what's on people's minds. And what you really want to get at is the stuff people talk about over coffee, over a beer after work, when they're in the parking lot. What do they worry about? And you want to get those issues out on the table so they're able to focus on other things. So that practice started in 1980. I learned that was quite effective. And so,
did you do it anonymously?
Of course.
Okay, so people would not write their name on the question.
No. So I did it there. I did it at another business that I then ran. I did it at National Gypsum multiple times. I did it at Sunoco. When I went down to run Sunoco products. So, I learned over the years.
You don't keep doing something over and over again if it doesn't work. That's for sure.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of open and transparent communication. And, for example, you go down to Sunoco products, a 100-year-old company, great traditions in the middle of South Carolina. I don't sound like I'm from South Carolina. I'm not a member of the family. So how do people get to know you? So what did I do the first year? I visited 100 plants in 28 countries. Out of 22,000 employees, we had 2,700 down in Hartsville. So I went into the mills, and I started taking questions from a question box. That gave them a chance. I wanted to find out what was on their mind. That gave them a chance to understand about me. And I remember HR coming in the first time saying, "You can't answer that question." I said, "That's the first one I'm going to answer." So it said, we cut and we cut and we cut. I had just gotten there, too, keep in mind. We cut and we cut and we take these positions out at the paper mill. Is that how you plan to pay for that big house you're building on Caroline Avenue? And, of course, they never expected me to answer that question. I said, "That's a good question. That's between the bank and whatever money I get out of the house up in Charlotte, North Carolina. But you're right. There are changes going on in the mill, and I'm glad you raised that question. Let's talk about that." So that gave me gave them a chance to get to know me, and also for me to find out what was on their minds. When I came to National Gypsum, within 6 months, I visited 57 plants and sales offices, met with 150 customers. That's all I did. Went to two conventions. I'd go into the plants or the sales offices, go through my background, where I was coming from, like, what's on your mind? And then once we got into the bankruptcy, I used that question box because it's a high level of stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting way to go about it. And it shows to me that you're making yourself very human to your team, your people, right? But by answering those tough questions, right? You could have... It's political season. You could have pulled your politician act and glossed over it or changed the subject, but you take stuff head on. It must have made you feel very human
even though you knew you had to make tough decisions. And I think people appreciate that. I really do. One of the things that we've talked about a lot lately is a concept or a mindset shift around leadership. Most people think of a leader's responsibility as being for the results. A leader is responsible for the results. I tend to look at it differently. I think a leader is responsible for the people who are the people are responsible for the results. What's your first thought or response to that mindset shift?
Well, again, we're talking about leadership in the context of businesses. And so that's quite different from other kinds of military and political. Mm-hmm. But in that context, the wrong person, regardless of the size of the company, can put the company in the ditch. And I give this example in our book, where I talk about Bob Nardelli at Home Depot, because I was sitting on the board of Lowe's. We were all watching, and certainly very much weren't competing with Home Depot. Mm-hmm. And within a year and a half, he put that company in the ditch. It took that board 5 years to figure out they'd made a mistake. So who took his place but Frank Blake, who also was from GE as Nardelli, was a lawyer, didn't know retail. That was one of the complaints about Nardelli. But his very different style, very quiet, even style, quieted that organization down. Now, could he turn that, put that company back where it needed to be, which he did quite successfully? Alone? No. That's leadership. It required him to get the right people in the right place and to be able to work together. So one person, regardless of the size, can put a company in the ditch. Not one person alone can put that company back where it needs to be. That's leadership. And he did a remarkable job. And he wasn't from the industry. He came from GE, but yet he got it done.
How do you, you've been around at this point hundreds, if not thousands, of executive leaders. Are there characteristics or qualities over the years that if you're looking for a replacement, like you just mentioned this example, are there qualities or characteristics in people, men or women, that you're looking for to move into an executive leadership role?
Well, yes. I mean, the short answer is demonstrated capacity to lead and to get things done. So
the track record, you mean?
Yes. I mean, first of all, leadership comes in 1,000 different forms. So it's introverted, it's extroverted, it's tall, it's short, it's heavy, it's lean, it's male, it's female, it's every color under the sun. People get results in very different ways, through the context of who they are, how their whatever lessons in life had helped form them, gave them their value system, but they get things done. And so what do you look for when you're sitting on a board? The board's single most important decision, since it can't run the company, couldn't have even tried, is to have the right CEO. So what you look for, hopefully you've taken the time to put logical candidates in jobs that stress them, that you get to see how well they do going up when things are good, when things aren't so good. This old cliche, you're never quite as good as your numbers, you're never quite as bad, is very, very true. Fame is a fleeting thing. I've seen it happen too many often. So-and-so is terrific, and 3 years later, they're not doing quite so well. Whatever happened? Well, circumstance. So hopefully you've been able to have the crucible of real work in jobs, directing leading organizations, down below the CEO level. So you've had a chance to at least see them tested so that you're more likely to make the right decision about that individual. So that's more important than they have this personality, or I see the company in this particular circumstance for the next 5 years and we need someone that understands that. Things change, believe me. Mm-hmm. You think the next 3 years is going to be just like this? Wrong. I mean, no matter what you think, it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. And so you want to have an individual who has demonstrated, however they do it in the context of their personality and style, to get things done in a very systematic way, the capacity to lead, to elicit the willing collaboration of others over an extended period of time toward a worthwhile goal.
Is there, we've looked a lot at, you know, what are some of the really core things that, while everybody has different styles and everybody, you know, does it different ways, are there things that any leader at any level must get right? Oh, let me give you some context. We had Bill McDermott, the CEO of SAP, on, and he talked. He said, under no circumstance, I can make a lot of errors in my life, but the one thing I can't get wrong and my team should not forgive me for is not having a vision for where we're going to go and be in the future. And he talked about the purpose of the business too, but are there things like that where you say, we're human, we're going to make mistakes, but as a leader, you got to get these things right?
Well, I call that the vision thing, and quite often that's overdone when you're going into programs, you're in graduate schools, and they'll mm-hmm. talk about what does it take, you know, to lead an organization, and there's a chapter on, you know, the vision thing, or you can create a crisis to help, you know. I don't, the world, circumstances change too much. Each CEO you're going to talk to is going to have their own view about what they think is important. I do, back to really the question about what's common, mm-hmm. Above and beyond, leadership comes in 1,000 different forms.
Right, right.
Well, they are driven. They didn't get there by accident. They generally have a very high level of energy.
Can they be too ambitious?
Well, sure. I mean, it's the Julius Caesar and Shakespeare, Jan Cassius has a lean and hungry look. Such men are dangerous. So, sure. I mean, ambition alone doesn't. There are lots of ambitious people.
Mm-hmm.
I run into that when you're talking to students who, you know, I'd like my opportunity to do this and that. Ambition alone is not going to make things happen. I mean, you need to have luck, be in the right place at the right time, get support and help from others. Yeah, but there is a drive that helps you. Well, that kind of time and energy you have to put in, the sacrifices you make. I mean, you think when I just said I visited, my wife's at home with two kids, and I'm down here visiting 57 plants and sales offices, 150 customers. She's working trying to get a house built here. We go down to Hartsville, South Carolina. Our son is still with us going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gone. I'm visiting, well, she's building a house again, but 100 plants in 28 countries.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes an incredible amount of commitment, energy, and time. So I see it manifested in different ways. But if you were to go over here and see John Ferriola, who's the chairman and CEO of Nucor, Dan DiMicco before him, the amount of time that they spent out in the factories, out in the plants, talking with their investment committees, it's the CEO's job is 24/7 times two. Your schedule is endless. You have very little open time on your calendar. You have to work incredibly hard.
Is it lonely at the top?
Sure. It's very lonely. And because you have your bosses are a board of directors, I'm talking publicly traded companies.
Right.
They show up four times a year, maybe six, 24 hours. That's it. They come in at noon, you got your committee meetings, you have a dinner, everybody goes to bed, get up, you have breakfast, you know, usually with the CEO and the board, and then you leave at noon. They're gone. And you spend 2 weeks getting ready for that meeting, and then thank goodness they're gone so you can get back to work.
Right.
And so, yes, that's one of the things we do as Peter Browning Partners. So I work with CEOs who would like to have someone else to talk to other mm-hmm. than their board. Hopefully you've got the right kind of team around you that will give you support, that is willing to come in and say, hey, boss, I'm not sure that idea was really that good. Or you said something, and I know you think it's clever, but I'm not so sure it is. So you need to think again about the way you're phrasing something. So you need that kind of support around you so you're not the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah, it's a really in that answer, you talked about your wife being at home, four kids, seven grandkids. And you have such a decorated career. What is harder, leading at home or leading at work?
Well, that's a great question. And they're two totally different worlds. But I mean, you know, life is a contact sport. You're around long enough, you get all kinds of ups and downs. So I've been married twice. My first wife, we had two kids at home, and she was very ill. So I'm at home, 28 years of age, two very young children. She's in the hospital. I have a housekeeper. I think my life is over. I remember driving into work one day with tears coming down, thinking, what am I going to do? I work, I go home, I have dinner with the kids, and I drive off to the hospital. So so dealing with that. So as I said, we had four kids. I met Kathy. We've been married 42 years.
Yeah.
So we have hers, mine, and ours. And then our oldest daughter, who was 51, we lost her last year, was a recovering alcoholic. So learning how to deal with that. So that's life. Life is wonderful. We've had incredible family experiences. We've traveled all over the world. We do amazing things together with family, but that's just the reality of life.
Yeah, it can be hard.
Yeah, well, of course. Life is full of the speed bumps of life. So, but the beauty of a family is you can be CEO in the office and everybody pays a lot of attention to you only because you control their lives and their jobs. Mm-hmm. But you get home and you're not the CEO. And everybody learns how to work in different ways as a family together, making and sharing experiences, decisions that you do. So two very, very, very different. And quite frankly, they're equally challenging. But on the long run, at this point in my life, it's a lot more gratifying because to me, life is about family and friends. So it's the family. Yeah. And how you deal with and helping them at this point in their lives.
How much, when you were going through that journey of executive from company to company, were you concerned with the development of your people?
Very. I mean, that example I just gave you earlier about Frank Blake, you're only as good as your people. I feel I'm very, very open and candid. I had my first job to be a general manager of a business. I got the team together and said, look, we're going to do this together, not doing this alone. Mm-hmm. We're going to share where do we need to be going with this business? What are our objectives? How can we get there? So I took that lesson of being very open, delegating to a high degree, sharing together, working together, trying to do the right things about people. I mean, we changed performance management there. Started this very open communication I described earlier down in the plants, reaching out with customers, put an incredible amount of energy together. Mm-hmm. The way we developed our format of that team meeting once a month where we'd share objectives, we'd all openly talk about those, we'd support each other. We had fun.
Yeah.
We actually had fun.
Yeah.
In that we had fun at National Gypsum. If you run into people who were there when we were going through the bankruptcy, they say, well, that was a great time. Because despite that challenge, that existential threat, mm-hmm. when that first happens, because you're worried about your job and your pay, we did a lot of great things. We introduced new products. We had fun doing the things we were going about as we were actually building share in a very difficult time.
I think even the fact that you can smile and laugh during such a difficult time and have fun at work, I mean, I tell people all the time, I love what I'm doing, right? I love to come to work. And I see a lot of people that just, it's almost sad to see the engagement, the statistics of engagement at work today are god awful. I mean,
right.
They're terrible.
Right.
And it almost makes me sad to know that people spend 60% of their waking hours working at a job or jobs, plural, and not being fulfilled in the work that they do. How much as a leader do you think about the fulfillment of your employees or the fulfillment of what they get out of being at work?
Well, that's the derivative of creating an environment where you respect individuals. Well, I think of Nucor when you ask that question, because you walk in there and you're going to find out, there are always exceptions, but employees, whether down in the mills or in the office over here, who love coming to work. They love that company. And that was a culture created over a long period of time, starting with Ken Iverson. So what did he do? He was very, very open. His door was always open. They had virtually no overhead here at the corporate office, none. Even today, they only have 80 people over there out of 23,000. Very mm-hmm. few layers. Direct connection between the top of the house down. When things didn't go well, the top of the house didn't get his pay didn't go up, and so that created an environment over time where people trusted each other. Mm-hmm. They had confidence that the senior management was looking after their best interest.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the... What's most interesting about what you said is the environment to me, right? Creating a culture and an environment where people can be fulfilled in the work that they do and be excited about coming to work. And so many companies today, you see layer after layer after layer of management. I mean, even there are countless examples in the last 6 months of just layers of management being laid off because they just, companies have figured out we got too many. You know, we got people that report to people that report to people, and nobody ever makes a decision. Some of my best friends here, even in town at the bank, the bank's kind of has a negative perception of how many layers of management they have. And then these decisions come across people's desk and nobody really wants to make them because they want to get that group buy-in and they want to get the person above them to get at least a blessing on it, right? So I think there's a lesson there with the layers of management an organization has, and there might be a perfect fit for how many there are, particularly in a larger company. You're 75 years old. You're in probably the best shape of any 75-year-old I've ever seen. Where does that passion for health come into play, and what are some of the things that you do on a daily basis that you would recommend any leader as they grow and as they get older to do on a daily basis?
Well, there are two parts to that, the exercise and the health. And the, so I was always interested in sports, so I was involved in high school and college. I ran cross country, I ran track. So I had this love of running. It was my way of relaxing. It was my way of dealing with stress. And when I started traveling internationally, it was my way of dealing with jet lag. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, when I would come home, it had been a long day, Kathy would hold dinner so I could go out and run. I didn't have a drink. So that was my way. And even back then, I would be doing my push-ups. I'd be doing my pull-ups. And so so tied in with that was the spirit of adventure. So I've climbed all over the world. I've scuba dived all over the world. In fact, I'm going with our son. We did sea kayak 600 miles off the coast of Norway, 600 miles above the Arctic Circle off the coast of Norway. Or down in off the Vancouver Island or the Sea of Cortez. Or, as I say, we've climbed and biked and you named it.
Everywhere.
So that I've taken that exercise into my love of history and geography it's manifested itself into those kinds of activities. But I've always been involved or made exercise very much a part of my life. And I enjoy doing it, number one. Number two, it gives you a vitality and an energy that you need. If you're going to lead a business, if you're going to be visiting 100 plants in 28 countries.
Gotta have some energy.
Yeah, I mean, man, you yes, absolutely. Yeah. If you're going to deal with the kinds of challenges that required as a CEO. But once I retired and had a little more time, I've just built it in. So my day is I woke up between 5:30 and 6. I got up, worked out for an hour. I have a routine today was weights along with my push-ups and sit-ups and crunches.
And, do you listen to music as you do it?
On the weekends. I watch CNBC.
Okay, good.
So, you know, I'm still on lots of boards.
Yeah.
That's the best business show. I stay informed. They've got political.
Markets.
So I enjoy doing that. And then I read 3 papers today. And I've got lots of stuff on my iPad, but I get the hard copy of the Charlotte Observer. It doesn't take very long.
Right.
Wall Street Journal and the New York Times.
So you read 3 papers a day.
Yes.
You work out.
Yes. And then I'm ready to sit in my office or do whatever. I come over and visit with you. So I did all that, read the papers, had my breakfast.
All before 9 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Ready to get on with the day.
I understand. I think it has been said that, you know, your life is the small things that you do repeated daily. And it sounds like you have this repeatability to your day that keeps you at a high level of performance. And I think there's a lesson in that for anyone at any age. You know, if your schedule is unpredictable and you're not doing some of these things well, the structure, the discipline that that I believe it takes to become a good leader, or just to become a good human being for that matter, is affected by not having the routine and the schedule that you do now. How often do you think about learning? How often do you think about your own personal development as a man and as a leader, as a human?
Well, I loved reading. I loved history, so that was always a passion. But I remember when I started working. So I was a sales trainee selling packaging in Michigan, okay, mm-hmm. in 1964, 65. But for whatever reason, I wanted to get all... I remember the manager at the time says, Browning, we can't afford all these magazines. So I was getting... I didn't even know what... didn't mean anything to me. Harvard Business Review. I got all these packaging books. We were dealing with food companies, so I was getting material from the Department of Agriculture in Michigan. So when I was meeting with a man who ran a business, and he was, I don't know, whether it was grapes or apples or other kind of fruit, I mean, I knew all about the crop. And so I'd always, and then papers, always was quite interested in keeping abreast of what was going on. I got Fortune, I got Business Week. So even in sixth, when I wanted to be informed. I wanted to understand. A lot of it I didn't really get. I mean, it was way above my pay grade. But it was a way of being informed about the world around you. And I found that was always very, very helpful. And so that interest, I mean, at one time we were getting 35 or 40 magazines. I mean, today I still have them on a spreadsheet on my computer so I can keep track of when their renewal, because they keep moving the renewal updates for their own cash flow. So I don't want to pay them too soon. So, I mean, it's everything from Scientific American, Archaeology Today, you know, I mean, the Fortune, the Business Week.
Do you think that helped you? Do you think that helped you in your leadership career, particularly when it comes to, you know, making decisions about what direction a business might go or how to coach a CEO, just having a broad knowledge base of the world and the markets and where it might be going? Did that have any impact, you think, on how you even coach today?
Well, being informed, yes. If you are going to sit and have a conversation with someone, understanding their business, understanding the context of what's going on, let alone in the world, you never know where a conversation is going to take you. And as you go up in the business world, you run into better, more well-informed, traveled individuals. So it's not like they're a blank slate. Mm-hmm. So being able to have a conversation with them, being informed about what's on their minds, being informed and aware of what's going on around you is critically important. So I think, number one, I'm interested in the topic, so it was mm-hmm. easy to do. I like to be...
Yeah, genuine interest.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then number two, as a consequence... Is that a pivotal? I'm not sure. For me, I just enjoyed understanding what was going on around the particular business I might have been involved in, what was going on in the world around me. So between the magazines and the books, it's either mysteries or history. So, yeah. I mean, my office it looks like an academic. It's just piled high with history yeah. books.
Well, I think that the net here for any professional at any point in their lives, the curiosity that's required, or the curiosity of continuing to learn and continue to educate, can be something that separates someone. And it's, you don't think about it in the moment, but over years of being curious, I do believe it creates a real differentiation in people. So of everything that you just said, I think of the word curiosity, and you certainly have it. I would be remiss today if I had you here and didn't ask you these two questions. The first is, what's the best investment you've ever made?
Well, probably graduate school. And I went through the EMBA program at the University of Chicago, because when I got out of school, MBAs were just starting, so I graduated in 63. In 1953, there were only 3,500 MBA degrees granted. So it had just started to grow in its early days. Mm-hmm. And I kept asking, do I need to get an MBA? Well, you need to decide. And so when I started working, when I was up in Michigan, I started at the University of Michigan. We transferred me to Chicago. So then I got connected with the University of Chicago. And so I got an incredible education. The quality of the faculty, Merton Miller and Modigliani, Nobel Prize winner, The Art Laffer, the Laffer Curve, and I mean, I can still remember Roberts and statistics. I can still remember Lana Schrage and linear programming. I still remember all the faculty, yeah. Ed Rapp, and so that did it. Well, I think it helped. I still remember the case studies I had, the lessons learned. So it was.
It's a completely fine. I mean, think of where. There sometimes can be difficult to pinpoint exactly why that was the best investment, but I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me, right? With all the executive experience that you've had, having a foundation of a business school and the case studies and the mentors and the teachers, I mean, there's no doubt that probably played a big part in your success over the years.
It was just an extraordinary education and experience. And so, you know, I had the imprimatur of saying I had an MBA from the University of Chicago. But more importantly, were the lessons learned. And so I stayed connected. I used faculty to help me from this case study, the Harvard case study I mentioned. I had sent it on to one of the faculty members there and who did a lot of consulting. He said, Peter, that is terrific. Would you mind working with me? So what a kick that was.
Right.
So that's how I got on my first board. He was consulting with a company up in Hartford in 88. Phoenix Home Life, which is a life insurance company. Mm-hmm. And so I went in with him. He used the Peter Brown and Continental Whitecap case study.
You know, it's really funny. I have been in a classroom that's taught that case study, and I didn't note it. I didn't know. I didn't put two and two together until right now.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I took a 12-week program at Queens, and that case study was one of the case studies from Harvard Business Review. Two quick things, Peter. The first is, what advice would you give to a professional out there that is moving through the ranks in whatever organization they are, whatever career path they're on? What advice would you give them if they have aspirations to lead people and lead teams and organizations?
Well, and one of the things that helped me is you've got to be willing to take some risks in terms of opportunities that may come along. You just never know what's going to come your way. Did I get, as I was going up, moving up the organizational ladder, and keep in mind, I started as a sales trainee at 60,000 people, ended up at Continental as one of the EVP's operating officers. I took risks. I got frustrated. Some jobs I wanted, I didn't get. They said, we are not ready yet. I couldn't believe that I wasn't ready. But they were right. And that happened numerous times. Others, I remember taking a job that had a lot of risk with it, and the guy later said, Browning, you're either extraordinarily lucky or you're really good. And I'm not sure which it is, but I had taken a job that others said they didn't want. And I just, it was the right thing for me. It gave me a chance to manage a large group of people for the first time in my life. So that was in my mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
So you heard me earlier, stay informed, be engaged, understand not just your own business, but what the world around you, that's going to help you, I think. It's personally rewarding also. And then be willing to take risks when those... By that I mean, well, I took a risk coming down for National Gypsum. There are multiple opportunities.
It is a little bit counterintuitive, right? Because most people think in corporate America, you're in this safe zone and there is no risk to take. And so to hear you say that you took risk in corporate America, I think is fascinating. I really believe that most people today, which is unfortunate, that most people today think they need to go be out on their own or they need to leave XYZ job to go take a big risk, when many times there's risks that you can take within a big company that can set you up on a different path trajectory as well.
Absolutely. In fact, if you look at the case study, what the case study talks about is I had just been at this other division, Bondware, successfully turned around. We were making acquisitions. They asked me to go over to the Whitecap division. And in the case study, it says, this will be the test of Peter's career because, I mean, not to go into the details of the case, but, you know, they needed change, but they couldn't afford to lose it. It was the most profitable business, and they didn't know what change was needed, but they needed me to do it. I mean, anyway.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating thought. I have so many friends in corporate America, and there's plenty of risks to take in corporate America. I think there's a good point there. Let's get real quickly the book, The Director's Manual.
came out not long ago by Wiley, A Framework for Board Governance. Why'd you write it, and why should people pick it up?
Well, I had written a chapter working with CCL, Center for Creative Leadership, and with Boston University, where I did a lot of work with them in their graduate school on my case study. So this is 5 years ago. So they asked...
John, what's the CEO, Center for Creative... in Greensboro, right?
Yeah.
John Brown, is it John?
Well, I guess. I went over there twice, and we met with 14 authors. 13 were academics. I was the only one from the outside, the real world, if you will.
Right.
And so we had to write a chapter. It was around leadership. They're all, and these are, most highly regarded academics around leadership. So my chapter was on leadership in the corner office, the board's most important responsibility. And so that was published 5 years ago. And so my partner, co-author, Will Sparks, said, "You've got to write a book." And I said, "Well, man, I don't, what do I need to do?" And so he's the one that put me in touch with a writer that he knew at Queens. And so she helped me write those first two chapters. And then...
off you went.
Off we went. Well, then we got Wiley to pick us up and... And so it was sharing, you know, having served on 14 boards, that experience, really practical experience. So it's meant for boards. It's meant for CEOs. It's meant for people who aspire to join boards. It's meant for senior management.
Well, I it's certainly a fascinating thought and a window into a world that most people aren't familiar with. And so I think... if you have any aspirations to move into executive leadership, or if you're in a big company and you want to get a glimpse into the window of what actually happens behind those closed doors, it would be a great way to spend a few hours reading the book. But Peter, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to share some of this wisdom over the last 50 plus years of your career. We're really appreciative.
Thank you, John. My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It's a real pleasure and honor to bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to the leaders of tomorrow. It would mean a great deal to us wherever you listen to the podcast if you'd leave a rating and review. It helps with our exposure and reach more people. It would also mean a great deal if you share this episode with other friends and colleagues that you think might be useful or on your social media accounts. So until next time, we hope this helps you be a leader worth following.